Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dory, the communications manager here at the Denver Audubon. We're an independent, nonprofit chapter of the National Audubon Society, and we believe that birds are not just beautiful, they're vital. They're messengers of ecosystem health, and when we protect them, we also nurture the well-being of our communities, the environment, and the planet. This podcast, The Curious Bird, is part of a larger effort to uplift what we call a voice of the sky, a growing community of people like you who feel called to speak up, act boldly, and care deeply for the future of Earth and all her wild beings. Our goal is to share the stories of inspired advocates and to reflect on the creativity, interconnectedness, and wonder that the natural world awakens in us. We hope these stories spark lifelong learning, deepen your sense of stewardship, and remind us all of the power of collective care. So, wherever and whenever you're tuning in from, thank you. We're so glad you're here. Let's take flight together and dive into today's episode of The Curious Bird. I am so excited to have Emily Davenport here with me today. She is the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance. And I just got to share, I was so excited to get an email back from you because my intention has been to amplify all these animal-loving voices in the area. And so I went to the little inquiry box on your website and was like, would you be willing? And you responded. And that is just so wonderful. I'm sure you're so busy. And so thank you for your openness and willingness to be here.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for reaching out to us. Yeah. And thank you for having me on the podcast. We love your mission at Denver Audubon, so I was so excited to hear from you. That way, not only can we share our mission, but we have a very similar synergy with what we do out in the environment, so yeah. I was very excited to share our story.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that, and the feelings are mutual, and even just driving up here today and hearing the bird song and being on just a slightly bumpy, rocky road, I'm out here, and I felt myself, my breath deepen, expand, being out here in nature. And so what's that like for you coming out here every day?
We feel very lucky. So here, our facility is on a beautiful 3,600-acre preserve on Cherokee Ranch and Castle Foundation property. So we kind of joke around that it's kind of like a little central park surrounded by all of this urbanization. So it really is a mecca and a safe space for wildlife, especially birds. So you probably saw the bluebirds as you drove in, which is really cool.
Yeah. I feel like whenever I see wildlife, I mean, whether I'm out here in the mountains or whether I'm in the city, I feel like I'm in the right place.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredible how the noise of life kind of falls away when you are embraced with nature. It's something that I think each and every one of us should endeavor to get in our lives regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's essential, that connection.
Definitely.
So I'd love to read your bio get you introduced and get started. So after nearly two decades devoted to providing care to both pets and wildlife, Emily M. Davenport, CWR, RVT, founded the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance in 2017. She has been a veterinary professional for close to two decades, serving in multiple small animal and exotic practices. She is a licensed wildlife rehabilitator with the state of Colorado and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. She is also internationally certified in wildlife rehabilitation by the International Wildlife Rehabilitation Council, making her one of only six people in the state of Colorado with this designation. Emily's area of interest and expertise is raptors, with a background in the veterinary field and sound ecological practices. She has worked with raptors as small as flammulated owls and as large as California condors. Emily earned her BFA in illustration from the Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design, where her focus was on veterinary and medical illustration. Wow.
It's a mouthful.
It's amazing. And the first thing I want to say is just thank you for your time. Thank you for your service.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
So I'd love to know, walk me through. It's 2017 and you decide and are inspired to create the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance. What was the inception? How did that come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the time I was working with another raptor center and kind of learning the ropes of how to rehabilitate and educate through this type of conservation effort. And I realized that we weren't really communicating with other wildlife professionals and other rehabilitators in the state of Colorado. And I kind of realized that we were all these little islands all by ourselves, not sharing information, not sharing knowledge. And I thought, gosh, what a shame. Mm-hmm. What an opportunity there is here to collaborate, to create a sense of community, and to benefit wildlife more if we could work together more. And so that's really where the idea of the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance mm-hmm. came from. That word alliance is important because we want to create this community of collaboration where we can utilize knowledge sharing for the greater benefit of wildlife, because I'm a big believer in the wildlife realm and ecology and wildlife conservation. It's not a competition. Mm-hmm. We all have to work together. We're all on the same team. And the more we can work together and challenge each other to be better, the better it's going to be for wildlife.
Mm, I love that. I love all the themes that you brought up, and particularly the energies of competition versus mm-hmm. collaboration. And I find that our overculture and society, there has been an unfortunate cultivation of hyper-individualism mm-hmm. and competition. And so swinging the pendulum back towards collaboration only helps everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we all win, we all win.
Exactly.
So why wouldn't we want that for each other? And when you think of our each individualized missions, mm-hmm. Those missions help the environment, mm-hmm. help conservation, helps wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so it's only a win-win for everyone.
Absolutely. And there's so many beautiful things, but there are so many issues, and worrying about everything mm-hmm. is overwhelming. And so when we have our pockets of devotion, we're creating this stronger web of all these different areas we're reaching and helping.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've personally encountered in my career is a lot of gatekeeping in the field. Mm. And it's something that I really strive every single day to combat for people that are in their early career, trying mm-hmm. to break into the field. I want to share my knowledge. Yeah. I want to be able to get somebody's foot in the door. That's one of the really positive things about wildlife rehabilitation that a lot of people don't think about. They often mm-hmm. think about that we're just taking care of a whole bunch of squirrels and releasing them back into the wild, and there's not a lot of science in there, but we use a lot of science-based practices and mm-hmm. a lot of ecology in what we do. And one of the important things that we do is we are a launch pad for mm-hmm. early career individuals wanting to break into the field of wildlife. And so mm-hmm. we have interns that will go into careers in wildlife law enforcement, field biology, ornithology, you name it, veterinary medicine. Mm-hmm. So we feel like we really are that community resource. We really are important.
Yeah, how beautiful and how powerful to create that foundation and to pass the torch, because the earth will be in the hands of the youth and already is becoming in Absolutely. The hands. And so there's nothing better than just encouraging more love and more wisdom and more care. And to gatekeep that again is keeping those islands that you mentioned in the
Exactly.
beginning.
And that's what we're trying to do here at the Wildlife Alliance, is kind of break that stigma, invite people in, and really truly create that community and that sense of belonging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that we're speaking to this. And I actually wrote down a quote on your website, and it says, "Our vision is to elevate the care and production of wildlife by fostering a sense of community and collaboration through the Alliance." And so why, in other words, are community and collaboration critical for elevating coexistence?
Yeah, that's our mission.
Like, yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
It's all about that, is how we can create that sense of belonging, mm-hmm. create that sense of collaboration. Because again, I'm a huge believer that not one individual or one organization can fix the world's problems mm-hmm. alone. We have to work together. Mm-hmm. And so creating that collaboratory effort, mm-hmm. Whether it's doing research together mm-hmm. or, you know, knowledge sharing or, you know, going above and beyond that. Like, that's how we solve the world's problems, is together. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds maybe a little pie in the sky or like I have rose colored glasses on, but it's the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, things are so polarized right now mm-hmm. and we are all on these little islands. Mm-hmm. And so if we can just bring ourselves together, find that commonality and put that effort into action, gosh, it would be incredible the things we could do.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I love leaning towards possibility, leaning towards the pie in the sky. And for me, that's one of the lessons that the birds of the sky teach us,
yes.
is to reach into possibility, to imagine beyond where we've been before. Because if we can't imagine it, we can't get there in the first place.
Absolutely. I definitely take a lot of my thoughts and beliefs from nature and kind of watching and observing what they do. So using birds as an example, you know, just the fact that a little tiny flammulated owl makes this incredible migration down to Mexico and then all the way back up to Colorado again, like that's insane that they have that ability. And there's so much research that shows that they even will hold over in New Mexico for a period of time waiting for weather to subside before they come back up. So kind of using that strength that nature has and kind of pulling from that is something we can all do.
Yeah. What would you say in the last couple decades has been one of the most poignant lessons that nature has taught you?
I think the biggest one for me is don't give up, survive, like keep going. And not to keep using bird migration as a metaphor, but I mean, it's something truly special. You know, when you think of a peregrine falcon or a Swainson's hawk that has, those are two of the longest migrations that we have in the Americas. And so the fact that they keep going and, you know, many warbler species, for example, will migrate over the Gulf of Mexico. Like that's bonkers to me. And so the fact that they keep going, they persist. And despite, you know, the world we live in, despite some of the challenges that are out there, they still do it. They still get up every day and survive. And I think we can use that same mentality of just like, get up, do it, survive.
It's such a beautiful reminder of aliveness. I was so excited to see in your bio that you have a particular connection with raptors, which I didn't know prior to your bio. So tell me about that. What inspired that?
Well, you know, everybody talks about their spark bird. And so my spark bird was a red-tailed hawk. You know, they're often underappreciated, but there's so much cool research going on about them right now and all the different subspecies they have and how adaptive they are. Just kind of made me fall in love with them. And then the more I learned about raptors, the more I just fell in love that way. I always thought I would go into some kind of animal science field. And I always thought I would work with wild canines of some kind, you know, wolves, coyotes, foxes, right?
Yeah.
It's so interesting. But instead I'm working with the wolves of the sky, you know? And so raptors are just incredible. Again, kind of tying back to that ability to thrive in such changing times. And there's so much diversity all over the world with raptor species. Like it's just, you never get bored.
I love that. I love that you brought up almost this magnetism to birds and raptors too, because I feel the same way. And I've always been particularly connected to canines and wild canines as well. But the birds have always guided me. My work has consistently found my way to them.
Yeah. It's really interesting how that happens. And you know, raptors were kind of the gateway to other birds for me as well. You know, I have some really hardcore birding friends. And, you know, I was the one for the longest time that, you know, we'd go birding and all I cared about was the raptors. But then it started opening up all these other species and all these other niches in the environment. And it's just like, how cool is that? And the more I learn and observe in the wild makes me a better practitioner here in our facility too. So it's kind of a full circle, really cool thing.
Yeah. What was a bird that really unexpectedly excited you?
Vultures.
Oh, love them.
Right. I know. For anybody who's a bird lover, it's like, well, yeah, duh. But, but for anybody that's like new into birds or just getting, you know, into birding or learning about ecology, a lot of people are excited by the brightly colored birds, the beautiful birds. But I feel like vultures and scavengers are often underappreciated, underrecognized, and when I first started learning about vultures and working with them, you kind of learned how incredibly intelligent they are. They have this social intelligence because they are a social species. And so seeing that up close and personal and watching the wheels turn in their head and then watching that in the wild where you watch some kind of a hierarchy as they're feeding on a carcass or, you know, you can see them working together to solve a problem. It's incredible. So they were one that definitely surprised me. And again, kind of like everything else, the more I learn, the more excited I get. And, you know, that's kind of a analogy for why we do what we do as well, too, because the more I learn about them, the more I want to conserve them, the more I want to save them. And so if I can also share my same excitement with the public and the people that I meet, like I'm hoping they will want to save that species, too.
That's excitement is infectious.
Yes.
So walk me through a day here? I'm sure every day is different. You know, working with wildlife can be unpredictable and exciting and adventurous, but what's a day in a life like here?
Believe it or not, it's not as glamorous as you would think. But one of the things I absolutely love about this job is you learn something new every single day. No one day is the same. And that ability to learn and kind of feel like you're always in school and learning something new is so exciting. But a basic day in the life is, you know, our team comes in the morning. Usually we have a little team huddle, talk about the day, what animals are in the most critical condition, so which animals need care first. Here at the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance, we are a wildlife hospital and rehabilitation center. Mm-hmm. And we take everything from hummingbirds to bobcats and everything in between. Mm-hmm. But of course, that area of experts and interest for us is birds of prey. So they're our conservation priority. Mm-hmm. But as a team, we'll kind of go over who are the most critical patients, who needs care first. We kind of divide up the work and kind of send volunteers and interns and staff into different directions. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is welfare checks in the morning, making sure animals are okay. We start doing morning meds, morning feedings. We provide supportive care if needed in the form of thermoregulation, fluid therapy, oxygen treatments, that sort of thing. And then throughout the day, we will do feedings and cage cleanings and things of that nature. And then once the volunteers leave for the day, that gives us our afternoons to do procedures and diagnostics and things like that. It's a great opportunity when we have interns on site during internship seasons. They really get a lot of hands-on experience, a lot of opportunity to see some really cool things. So there's definitely some veterinary medicine involved in what we do. I really believe that wildlife rehabilitation is just kind of a veterinary adjacent field. So not so far off if done to the standard of care that is high quality care.
So why are birds of prey for Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance a conservation priority?
Great question. Being Denver Audubon, you know that birds are in trouble. You know, we've lost billions of birds since the 70s. That's scary. Raptors specifically, there was a study a few years ago that was done that showed that we've lost 52% of the world's raptor population. Terrifying.
Terrifying.
Even more terrifying, vultures. We've lost 90% of the world's vulture population.
I did not know that statistic.
Super scary. And so that is one of the reasons why they are one of our greatest conservation priorities. We believe that every raptor that we can put out into the wild helps aid in those population numbers. One of the things that make us really unique at the Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance is our approach to wildlife rehab. A lot of rehabilitators take the every creature counts approach and focuses on the individual, where we kind of take a more science-based approach. So not only are we taking the individual into consideration, but we're also considering what our decisions are going to do to the population as a whole, what our decisions are going to do to the ecosystem as a whole, and also what our decisions are going to do to the community as a whole. And so we believe that every raptor we get back out into the environment helps the population as a whole, helps the ecosystem as a whole, which in return helps the community as a whole as well. So we really feel that the work we do with raptors in particular are really beneficial to the ecosystem. And there was a great study that just came out last year called Dead Birds Flying that essentially proved that rehabilitation can be a positive mitigation tool for incidental take for raptors. They've been able to prove that our work with raptors adds to a population level, which is pretty cool. Those kind of studies have never been done before. So it's kind of validating the work that we're doing finally.
Absolutely. And to see that reflected back just must feel so fulfilling.
It does. We've always, as a community of rehabilitators, known that the work we're doing is important. But because we're nonprofits or because we're home-based individuals, oftentimes we don't have the financial resources to do those sort of studies. And so now that we have a community kind of surrounding us and wanting to take on those studies, it's kind of validating what we've always known. And it does feel really good.
And fortunately or unfortunately, that credibility is often required for the financial level, like you said, the nonprofit.
Yes, absolutely. And that's challenging. I mean, Denver Audubon mm-hmm. probably understands as well. As nonprofits, we rely on the kindness of individuals, the mm-hmm. the generosity of corporations. Mm-hmm. We want them to fall in love with us, fall in love with yeah. our mission. And those sort of qualifiers, if you will, really mm-hmm. help to promote that.
They do. And the financials are critical.
Yeah.
And really, especially now, they're a vote, you know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
What a vote do of you confidence. Care for?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a... it's a worthwhile struggle.
We think so. Of course, we're yeah. biased, but you know, the more financial resources we have, the more mm-hmm. human boots on the ground that we have, the more impact we can make in our community. So mm-hmm. It's something we're always looking for, always yeah. kind of working towards. And again, it kind of goes back to that community of collaboration also. Like the more we can collaborate mm-hmm. financially and put our funds together, mm-hmm. the more each organization can do.
Mm-hmm. I'm really surprised to hear the statistic about the vultures. I had yes. no idea, 90%, and they're so essential for the environment. I like to think of them as threshold keepers, as guardians. They alchemize death back into mm-hmm. life. They keep our environment clean. They mitigate disease. They do so much for the environment and the planet.
Absolutely. They're nature's cleanup crew, as everybody always says. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to share some of like the cited sources with you too of some yeah. of these studies I keep mentioning.
Yeah, I would love that. Sweet. I would love that. Yeah. So what is it like receiving a wildlife patient, going through this tedious, devoted care, and then that moment of seeing them and having them released back into the wild?
Yeah. It's a mixed emotions, really.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, it must be so emotional, or you must be so sad to see this animal go. But oftentimes it's been a really stressful process, both for the humans and the wild animal. You know, these animals that come through our doors are not like our domestic dogs and cats. They don't understand what we're doing. They see and perceive us as predators. So, you know, when they walk through our doors, it's usually the worst day of their life.
Yeah.
They have failed as a wild animal, mm-hmm. and that's dangerous to wildlife. And so the process is oftentimes stressful for human and wildlife combined. We minimize stress as much as possible. We utilize best practices to, you know, help with fear, help with stress, help with pain, that sort of thing. And then once we get them through that process, we are actually as hands-off as possible. Mm-hmm. We don't want to tame these animals. We don't want to habituate these animals. And we, of course, don't want them to imprint on humans in any way, shape, or form. And so it's kind of a hands-off approach. So we don't necessarily get that emotionally attached to them. Mm-hmm. And so when it finally comes for release day, it's a really happy, positive thing. We want to get that animal back into the wild. That way they can be a part of their natural habitat, be a part of the breeding population that's mm-hmm. out there, and kind of give back to nature in that way. So mm-hmm. it's always a happy day.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing them in their freedom, in mm-hmm. their space again.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I joke with my team sometimes, I tell them on most releases, actually, if I'm ever to the point where I don't want to go on a release or mm-hmm. I am not excited to release an animal, it is time for me to throw in the towel, because mm-hmm. it's always an exciting day to see your hard work pay off and to see that animal get a second chance at being wild.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's beautiful. Is there a particular patient story that really impacted you or your team?
Yes. There's probably a few, honestly, but the one that comes to mind is a red fox. So not mm-hmm. a bird in this situation, although there's bird stories as well. We had a red fox come into our hospital last summer in the middle of busy season, the busiest time of year for us. And the fox came in with Arvada Animal Management, so animal control, with a huge arrow sticking out of it. And so this poor animal had been illegally shot by just a practice arrow, not even a hunting arrow. It was not hunting season. And we had to work to essentially save this animal. So we did all of our diagnostics and stabilization on that first day. We documented the case because it's, of course, a criminal case. So another opportunity where wildlife rehabilitation is really important. Not only do we help wildlife and early career individuals, but we also aid law enforcement when criminal activity is suspected. And so this was one of those situations where we wanted to document the case, make sure we took as much information as possible in hopes that we can get the bad guy, essentially.
Yeah.
And so the arrow was eventually removed. We stabilized the patient. We did all the diagnostics. Luckily, the arrow had not impacted any vital tissues.
Oh, wow.
No organs, no bones. It was all soft tissue. But unfortunately, the fox had had that arrow in her for quite some time. So she got this horrific infection. Despite us starting her on antibiotics and pain medications right away, it was just kind of too little too late. So she got this massive skin infection. And so not only did we have to stabilize the patient, but then we had to switch into wound treatment mode. And she had these massive wounds on her sides and her back. She actually lost 50% of the skin on her torso. And long story short, through months and months and months of rehabilitation, she healed beautifully. Mm. She had like the smallest, like quarter inch scars where the original arrow site had been. You'd never know she lost all that skin. Her fur grew back beautifully. And she was released in a safe sanctuary in Arvada, far away from where she was originally shot. So, yeah. So wow. That was a very happy, that was one of the more emotional releases, yeah. I guess I could say, because that animal took so much work,
yeah,
so many resources, and it was touch and go for months. We weren't sure yeah. we were going to be able to save her.
Wow.
So that is the power of wildlife rehabilitation.
Yeah.
That is the power of people's generosity and donations, cases like that, that we can then, through so much work, get them back out into the wild.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. And there's so much dedication and time that is required of you and your staff and your team. And like you mentioned, the emotions, what is it that in those trying experiences keeps you going?
It's the animals.
Yeah.
You know, the majority of the animals that come through our doors come to us because of anthropogenic causes.
Mm.
So human-caused problems, either accidental or intentional. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I feel like wildlife rehabilitation is a way to give back to nature.
Mm.
It's a way that we can offset the damage that humans sometimes cause. And, you know, by the animals, no fault of their own, walk through our door. So mm-hmm. I think that's what keeps me going. It wasn't the fox's fault that... Uh-huh. that happened. You know, chances are she was trying to go after somebody's backyard chickens, or
yeah.
she was just trying to survive. And there's so many different things we can do to coexist with wildlife mm-hmm. that aren't necessarily lethal.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things I'm really passionate about, is just kind of offsetting that human cause.
And speaking of coexistence, and you talked about that as your mission statement, for individuals, communities, and any type of environment that they live in, how can they elevate their coexistence with wild beings?
I love that. You know, I'm a big believer that wildlife rehabilitation is kind of a reactive form of conservation. We are reacting to problems yeah. in our environment, whereas education, research, and things like that are that proactive component.
Mm-hmm.
So the more education we can do about coexistence strategies, the better. And it kind of depends on what animals you're dealing with. You know, mm-hmm. for example, a lot of people don't like woodpeckers because, you know, they peck and drum on their house. They mm-hmm. cause property damage. But what a lot of people don't realize is if you like tiny forest animals, or
yeah.
tiny forest owls, I mean,
mm-hmm.
You better like woodpeckers because mm-hmm. they are creating habitat for animals like saw-whet owls, mm-hmm. flammulated owls, all those tiny little owls that we love. Bluebirds, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Different varieties of squirrels as well. They create that habitat. So instead of using lethal means or trying to get them out of an environment, creating habitat and actual nesting sites with mm-hmm. man-made nest boxes can help prevent property damage. There's all sorts of different deterrents we can utilize in our yard to help kind of prevent them and, you know, recommend that they kind of move on and find a better area. So there's a lot of things we could do depending on the species that don't involve like negative effects on them.
And I think that sometimes, going back to the beginning of our conversation, that hyper individualism can play into our perception of the natural world. And we can seem to forget at times that everything is interconnected.
A lot of people don't realize that if you get rid of the woodpecker, that gets rid of the mm-hmm. tiny owls, which then causes a explosion in the rodent population,
mm-hmm.
which then can potentially create an issue with hantavirus or mm-hmm. other diseases that these little rodents cause that can then make people sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is this kind of ever evolving cycle mm-hmm. that we need every species. We need that biodiversity to mm-hmm. kind of solve that the issues that we have at hand.
Yeah. And the earth has this organic wisdom of creating balance between all the species. And if we interfere and cause imbalance, we're taking ourselves out of the life cycle. We're disrupting the life cycle.
Absolutely. If we could just listen to that, mm-hmm. I think we'd be much better off as a species.
mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, a big one that I think about is we're at this huge decline in insect populations.
Yes.
And that is creating a huge decline in bird populations. And so, again, it's all interconnected.
It's all interconnected. And, you know, there's a big push right now, especially in Colorado. And I know Denver Audubon mm-hmm. is a huge proponent of this, is just creating natural habitat. Mm-hmm. Plant native plants. Mm-hmm. That's going to help those insect populations. That's going to help then in turn our bird populations mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So the more biodiversity we can create and the more native biodiversity we can create, mm-hmm. The better it is for those populations and the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Well, human development is also one of the biggest reasons for decimation of species. It creates a lack of connectivity, a lack of breeding grounds, a lack of all these things. And many of us have a yard or a garden that even just a few simple plants could help insects and birds, even a balcony, a plant on a balcony.
Exactly.
Can make a difference.
Yep. Plants, native food sources, nesting areas, mm-hmm. Put up a few man-made bird boxes mm-hmm. and plant some native plants and there you go. Like you'll yeah. just watch your yard explode.
It's lovely. If you listeners out there have not done it yet, I just moved into a place and put out a bird feeder and I'm planting plants and it's just... It changes everything in those mornings when you hear the bird song.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I just listened to another great podcast. I believe it was Bird Note, and I'll correct it if not. But they talk about how we measure cities and their success based on finances, mm-hmm. corporations, mm-hmm. businesses. And what if we based the success of cities on the amount of bird song, on the amount of wildlife, you know?
I mean, that's a beautiful thought, a beautiful mm-hmm. idea. I oftentimes, as a nonprofit leader, I'm also business minded. And yeah. so I'm often trying to think of how you can combine the two for the greater benefit of wildlife. Mm-hmm. And how cool would it be if, similar to arts districts and things mm-hmm. like that, we had a nature district mm. where funds could be put back into our parks and open space in different ways than they're already being utilized. Mm-hmm. And then also helping nonprofit organizations like ours to kind of continue the work that we're doing. I've always thought there has to be a way. There has to be a way to kind of monetize this for the benefit
yeah.
of wildlife and ecosystems. So somebody out there do something.
Yeah,
somebody
exactly.
help us.
There's a way, and it starts with this dreaming.
That's right.
You know, it starts with the pie in the sky ideas yep. and we'll find it. We are finding our way towards
yep,
that.
Exactly.
So you brought up busy season earlier.
Yes.
So would you tell me a little bit about what does it mean to be in busy season here?
Sure. Some wildlife rehabilitators call it baby season. Mm. We prefer to call it busy season mm-hmm. Because of the variety of animals and different species that we get. Mm-hmm. It's not always babies in our situation. On an average year, we take in about 1,000 animals per year, 116 different species, which is pretty crazy. Here in Colorado alone, I think we get over like 500 bird species or something crazy like yeah. that. And so we as rehabilitators have to know and understand the natural history for all the potential different species that we can get in, the behavior, the caging requirements, the seasonal feeding requirements that these animals get. So it can be a lot. There's a lot of studying and research that goes into what we do. On an average day in our slow season, we could have about 10 to 20 patients on site at a time, which is a good amount for our small rehab center. I like yeah. to joke, we're kind of a schmedium wildlife rehab center. We're not the biggest, we're not the smallest. Mm-hmm. We are growing mm-hmm. year after year. Like this year, we're 10% ahead of last year's intake numbers. So mm-hmm. we'll probably be well over 1,000 patients this year. But yeah, 10 to 20 in the slow season. During busy season, we can get upwards of anywhere from 60 to 80 patients on site Whoa. At one time. And that can look like, native baby squirrels that have come in and have been orphaned because their nest tree has been cut down, or an orphaned red fox that is emaciated and covered in fleas because something happened to the parents, or it could be an adult Swainson's hawk that collided with a window and is suffering from head trauma. It could also be a little garter snake that got stuck in a glue trap. And so there you go. There's those anthropogenic causes of admission again, kind of creeping up. And so in the summer, as you can imagine, more people are out and about, mm-hmm. more people are interacting with wildlife or engaging in, you know, plans in their yard. And so by the nature of, you know, the cyclical seasons of animals having babies and people just recreating outdoors, we get this huge influx of animals. So we have to turn animals away every single day during busy season. There's just not enough manpower here yet. We're working towards it.
Yeah.
You know, the more resources we have, the more good we can do and the more animals we can take in and help. But yeah, so we are very busy during busy season. You know, wildlife are not on a schedule. They're not on a 9 to 5. And so our days can be really long in the summer, sometimes 12-hour days or longer. My team here is incredible. And so there have been many a times where we are turning off the lights at the end of the day, getting ready to head out of the door, and then we get a call that a red-tailed hawk has been hit on I-25. And we turn the lights back on, turn oxygen on, and get ready to receive that animal. Because if we don't do it, nobody else is.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It is. What are some of the main anthropogenic causes that cause harm to animals, and how can we help mitigate that?
Oh, that's a great question, because there are things we can do. So our top three are vehicle collisions, collisions in general. We kind of lump everything into the collisions category, and that could be collisions with vehicles, collisions with windows, as well as collisions with random objects like fences, walls, wires, things like that. In regards to vehicle collisions, one of the very simple things that our listeners can do is just don't throw food out of your vehicle. We often forget that food being thrown out of a vehicle is still litter.
Yeah.
And it doesn't often biodegrade as quickly as we think. Mm-hmm. What that food does is it brings small rodents to the roadside. And you may think that you are helping those animals, and in a way you are, but what do small rodents bring to the roadside? Predators. So that's when coyotes and fox get hit. That's when great horned owls get hit. Because they are focusing on that prey animal and not the oncoming vehicle. So that's one simple thing we can do to help prevent vehicle collisions. Similarly, window collisions. Just put up some decals. Hang some nice things in your window to help let birds realize that that is a solid surface. Birds don't realize that they cannot fly through that transparent space. So that's number one, followed very closely by animal interactions. And that is in the form of cat attacks and dog attacks. So again, a very simple thing our listeners can do. If you love birds, keep your cat indoors. I'm a cat owner. I love cats. My cat drives me crazy in the summer when it's nice outside too, and she wants to go out. But there's a lot of fun things we can do to keep their minds engaged and enrich their lives inside. Or we can build a catio and keep them engaged and happy while outside, or harness train them and let them wander around the yard supervised with you. But cat attacks they make up a significant amount of our intakes during the summer months. So that's pretty tough, as well as dog attacks. Just having an off-leash dog in a park where maybe baby bunnies are being raised can be detrimental to that little bunny family.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And then the third most common cause of intakes for us are orphans. And so what people don't realize about those orphans, though, is oftentimes they are orphaned because of another anthropogenic problem that happened to their parents. So even though those are our three categories, we know other things like poisoning is happening to their parents. We are seeing things like entrapment in buildings, entrapment in string, fishing line, things of that nature. I've been surprised over the last year we've gotten a lot of gunshot victims in. So raptors that have been shot, cottontail rabbits and fox squirrels, things like that as well that you'd kind of expect. But the raptors, that's a pretty major federal offense. So we're surprised every time we see that. So oftentimes these orphans coming into our facility are coming in because something like that happened to their parents. I know.
I don't even know what, you know, and it's like every time I hear this information, it never weighs on my heart any less.
Right. I know. I know. You know, as professionals, as wildlife professionals, we can kind of turn it off. Mm-hmm. You know, there's days we get frustrated and there's days that we get mad and there's really sad cases that we see. But one of the other things that we are as a wildlife rehabilitation center is a community resource. And so we can help the community with these coexistence strategies. We can educate the public about things that they can do that don't hurt wildlife. Mm-hmm. And when we do receive wildlife in some of these distressing situations, we can also relieve their suffering in a number of ways. So that's one of the most important things that we do as licensed wildlife rehabilitators that doesn't often get talked about is that relief of suffering if they cannot be rehabilitated. And that in a kind of a strange way, I know it's maybe a little morbid, but that also gives me comfort when these sad cases come in is at least I could provide that peaceful passing.
Mm-hmm. I think that is such an important topic to bring up because I think of it on a personal level for myself with my dogs that I have cared for and being able to be a guardian and take the sacred responsibility that I have that is to mitigate suffering where I can.
Yeah, when we have new interns in or new volunteers, we remind them that, you know, compassionate euthanasia is still a treatment.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. And building that relationship with the beauty and care in death, too. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And so, you know, an animal can still be honored in death as well, whether it is just one of our statistics that we share with people like you, or, you know, we can utilize their remains sometimes for an education tool, respectfully, of course. And with the proper permits. But that way their life meant something. It wasn't for nothing, you know?
Yeah. And I think that allowing spaces to talk about that and to talk about the grief and the ecological grief as well for animals helps us to deepen our connection with them too.
Yes. And it's so interesting you brought up ecological grief. This is only the second time I've heard that term used, but it's something that we all feel. Mm-hmm. And it's that greater loss that is happening in our environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to kind of flip the positivity, we always try and keep things positive here, is, you know, that is one of the way wildlife rehabilitation gives back, is we're trying to offset that ecological impact, trying to help with that ecological grief a little bit, because it can be overwhelming for people sometimes where, oh my gosh, there's all this doom and gloom for the environment and in our daily life. And we want to make conservation accessible and attainable for everyone. And we want to create these little bite-sized pieces of information, this little package of education that we can then provide to the public that they can take home and put into action. That way it's not so overwhelming. And so that's one of the other really important things that we do is just making that idea that all hope is not lost more accessible to everyone.
Yeah, that's something we've been talking about a lot is the presence of hope and that from hopelessness, not much happens.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, if you don't have hope, what do you have? Mm-hmm. You know, I have hope every day. You know, we'll get a patient in that is non-responsive and I always have hope that we'll pull them through. And sometimes we do. If I didn't have hope, what would happen to that animal?
Exactly.
If we don't have hope, what happens to the environment? We have to be like our wild counterparts and survive until we thrive.
And what a beautiful gift to give that hope to those animals.
Absolutely.
Like you talked about.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I think it's really important what you brought up about ecological grief being something we all experience because I think that grief can feel and has the illusion of being isolating.
Yes.
And yet, when we see it as something that we are all in this, can we use it as a bridge between our islands to make a difference and to come together in community?
I think so. You just hit the nail on the head. When we can talk with our community about the things that are distressing us or the things we're worrying about or the things that we have hope over, it kind of brings us together and kind of ties back to both of our missions in a way of that community of collaboration. How do we collaborate together for hope? The possibilities are really endless, and there's so much that we can do individually. There's so much we can do on a day-to-day basis, just in our own home, our own neighborhood, our own community. And then, gosh, that's just amplified when you can create that community voice. So there's a lot we can do.
Definitely. And as a proponent of collaboration and community and someone who facilitates that, what are some tips you have to build community?
Oh, That's such a good question. I love that. You have so many good questions.
Thank you.
Volunteer. Mm. That's one of the best things you can do to get involved and feel like you're actually doing something and actually making a difference, because you are. Mm-hmm. Volunteers are incredible, whether you want to volunteer to educate the public or volunteer to plant some native plants or volunteer at a wildlife rehab center near you to help wildlife hands-on. There's so many different incredible organizations out there. It doesn't have to be a wildlife rehab center. Mm-hmm. There's so many environmental groups out there that you can work with. So even if you're able to do just 2 hours, 4 hours a week, or, you know, one event a month, whatever mm-hmm. the requirements of that organization is, it makes a huge impact. Mm-hmm. It makes a huge difference. And all of a sudden you're around these like-minded individuals creating that sense of community. Like, how cool is that? We're also understanding, though, that not everybody has the time or the ability to volunteer. And so, you know, donating money, it makes people feel good. They're giving to organizations that can utilize those funds for the things that they care about. But it's not always about the money. A lot of organizations can utilize just gently used items. So donating things off of organizations' wish list, office supplies. For us, it's things like old towels and newspaper, mm-hmm. you know, nothing that costs a ton of money, but helps greatly, especially during that busy time of year. Going to different education events. So there's so many free and inexpensive education events all around the Denver metro area, all over Colorado. Look in your local newspaper, on your local city and county websites for events near you. That's another way to find those like-minded community members.
I love that. And I love that the core theme really is action. And that is a big part of our mission statement, is inspiring action, because that action of doing, yes, helps the environment, impacts everyone around you. And also, I think it's okay for us to be honest with ourselves as humans that we like to have a tangible representation of our difference.
Yes.
And that's okay.
Totally.
Let's take the action so that we can see that. And it helps create a sustainable quality to the hope.
Yep, 100%.
What is an action that you've seen in your community? Maybe it was a staff member, and it can be anonymous, or maybe it's someone in your friend or family that you were like, wow, that small, simple action made a big impact.
I mean, something so simple, and it's not necessarily animal related or wildlife okay. related, but just a friend shooting you a text out of the blue saying, hey, I'm yeah. thinking about you. Like, just wanted yeah. you to know that I love you. Mm-hmm. You know, little tiny acts of kindness, little mm-hmm. tiny things like that. That we can also do in our everyday life. Mm-hmm. We are all experiencing that ecological grief mm-hmm. or environmental stressors right now. Mm-hmm. In the big picture, in the real environment, all the way to our home life environment can be stressful. Mm-hmm. So just reaching out to the people that you love and care about, even if you haven't done it in a really long time, even if it kind of makes you feel mm-hmm. vulnerable and makes you feel a little like, oh, I don't know if I should do this, just do it.
No, I've never regretted an
exactly.
act of love.
Yeah.
And the more love we can give and the more love we receive, the more we can give it out in other
100%,
ways too.
Absolutely.
So who knows? That text might have brightened someone's day and then they decided to go get bird seed or plant a flower.
Exactly.
You never know the, totally. You know, the chain of events. And so there again, we can play with the imagination of what could this one text do?
Yep, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'd love to bring up, because I know this is important to your mission as well, and we've talked a little bit about it, but Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance is a nonprofit rehabilitation center. You are also huge in education, so educating the public through animal ambassadors, through other means, and then also helping wildlife professionals expand their education and expand their career. So tell me a little bit about why is that important?
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. It is one of the things that is central to our mission. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you think back to 2017, when we were first getting started, and I was seeing that we were all these little islands, that's really where this education component started, mm-hmm. is I was really passionate about that proactive form of conservation, getting out ahead of things, educating the public, but also educating wildlife professionals. So in our field of wildlife rehabilitation, there aren't very many easily affordable or accessible mm-hmm. ways to continue our education. And, you know, not everybody can afford to travel to a national conference or take an online workshop. And so we created the Wildlife Care Conference 5 years ago. It's a virtual conference that is online for wildlife professionals like rehabilitators, educators, veterinary staff, students, or anybody that's interested in a career in wildlife. And it's just a way for them to get really inexpensive education accessibly right to their computer screen. And so we've done this now for 5 years. This year in January, we had our largest conference yet. We had over 300 individuals join us from all over the country and even all over the world.
That's amazing. From
as far away as Thailand and Namibia and places like that. So it's so cool to see that, like, yes, this is something that is really needed, and we're providing that to our global community. And then, of course, we work with a variety of different veterinary technician schools, veterinary schools. For example, this weekend we'll be at a large veterinary technician conference, kind of promoting who we are and what we do. And then we do all sorts of different wet labs and workshops here at our facility. So we invite veterinary students in, especially veterinary students that are interested in a career in wildlife medicine. So we can give them that hands-on experience that they can't necessarily get in school. But then there's that public component too. So we are very lucky. We're licensed through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have non-releasable education ambassadors, primarily birds of prey, that we can then take out to schools and events and festivals and things like that to kind of promote that conservation message, to promote that coexistence message. One of the other things we teach about, again, because we're all about education, is in a way we do a little bit of behavior science as well. And so the methods we use for training our education ambassadors are what's called choice-based training, similar to positive reinforcement. But essentially what that means is it gives our education ambassadors agency and choice over their life. They choose to participate or not. And so if you are ever blessed to see one of our education ambassadors out at a public event, they have chosen to come out and be there that day.
I love that. Why is that sovereignty for the animal important?
Oh, gosh. Because my background started in the veterinary field and in wildlife rehabilitation before I got into education, you think about these animals and what their life was like in the wild. I mean, take a turkey vulture who can soar effortlessly hundreds of feet up in the air and soar for miles without ever beating their wings. An animal in captivity, a turkey vulture in captivity, can't do that. And how sad is that, you know? And so the reason it's so important for me is how can I make this animal's life as positive as possible for as long as possible? And so providing them with environmental enrichment, like just basic things, branches, a foraging dish, puzzle toys to stimulate their brain, is so much better than just sitting in an enclosure and staring at four walls. And we're big believers that our birds' aviaries are their bedrooms, not their houses, meaning
like that.
That they don't spend a whole lot of time in there. They get to come out into the nature center here. They get to go outside. They get to go offsite to events. And we really try and enrich their lives as much as possible, because no matter how hard we try, we're never going to be able to simulate the wild.
Beautifully said. And thank you for taking that time and thought to bring quality to animals' lives.
Our pleasure. It's a longer process.
Yeah.
So it's a newer school way of training animals, raptors in particular, but it takes longer. Mm-hmm. So instead of training a red-tailed hawk in a few days or a few weeks, it can take months. Our great horned owl, it took 9 months to train him because it was his choice. He proceeded when he was ready.
And I love the word enrichment. And I was really first introduced to it. I used to work at the conservation-based AZA-recognized Santa Barbara Zoo in California. And so a big proponent of enrichment, and just reflecting on that word, it can be used a lot in the scientific animal sense, but when we really dive into it, it's bringing a richer life. And so we can bring that to all beings around us, and how can we enrich the lives around us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that, because whether they know it or not, like, I try and enrich my volunteers' lives while they're here, or my staff. And so animals are just a component of that as well. And it is really cool because there's all sorts of different ways you can enrich an animal's life or mm-hmm. a person's life.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like there's a lot of space for creativity in that.
Oh, yes. So that's one of the things we have our interns do mm-hmm. In the summertime is, okay, here's a tub full of cardboard. Mm-hmm. We need some shreddable enrichment for our mm-hmm. red tail talk today. Go ahead and use your creativity mm-hmm. and use your artistic abilities to kind of make something that they're going to have so much fun with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as an artist yourself, what do you think about the interplay of art, creativity, and wildlife?
There is so much interconnectedness that I don't think a lot of people realize. Mm-hmm. Science is an art. Mm-hmm. Art is a science. Mm-hmm. And we can utilize that. It takes creativity to do what we do on a regular basis. You know, coming from the veterinary field, I've talked to surgeons who are like, yeah, I'm also an artist. I use mm-hmm. my art every time I open up an animal to make sure that I am doing what I need to appropriately and closing them up and making it look nice, you know, when we're done so they look whole again. Mm-hmm. And so there's all sorts of art that we use on a regular basis. Like there's the obvious things, like I use my artistic skills for marketing and graphic design yeah. and our website, but on a less tangible scale, I'm using my creative mind every single day mm-hmm. to set up an enclosure for a spotted towhee or mm-hmm. to set up an enclosure with some really great branches for a wild turkey. That sort of thing takes creativity because mm-hmm. you have to observe what you're seeing in the wild and then take that back and put it into action or into an mm-hmm. art form, if you mm-hmm. will. So yeah, every yeah. single day we're using it.
Yeah. And I love just hearing you describe Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance and when you were talking about education and the conferences you hold and how I really see you here as a foundation for accessibility to that wildlife love and wildlife care, whether that's, you know, all around the world or whether that's it's not dependent on age. It's not dependent on finances. It's not dependent on location. And that is so beautiful to have places like this that offer that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it goes back to community. I know I keep saying it, mm-hmm. but that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And something we're really, really passionate about is not everybody has the ability to get that nature-based education. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really passionate and we are really passionate as an organization about making wildlife education, environmental education, more accessible, more affordable, so that more people can enjoy, understand, and take action in their own lives to, you know, do the things that need to be done in the environment.
Mm-hmm. And I find that that's what people want to do.
Yes.
And given the opportunity, they will.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They just need that opportunity. Mm-hmm. They just need that accessibility. So mm-hmm. hopefully we have expanded that and made that impact in our communities a little bit, and we'll continue to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think you absolutely have. I know you have.
We sure try.
Yeah. And I love when you were describing that of people tuning in from all over the world. It's also an example of how animal love transcends any boundaries or any idea and an illusion we have of separation.
Yep, absolutely. It's all connected. It's all connected. Interconnected. That, you know, bluebird outside our window right mm-hmm. now, or the robin somebody sees in their front yard. Like it's mm-hmm. all connected.
Mm. Well, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for joining me. And I would just love to ask and open it up if there's anything on your heart, your mind that you feel like you want to add or share or say.
Well, I'm so grateful to be here. This has been an absolute joy. So thank you so much again for having me. Mm. And we've really covered all the important points, you know, but I guess if I were to kind of end my thoughts is, you know, I hope that your listeners just never stop learning. Mm. You know, that's one of the things I love about this job is I learn something new every day. Like continue to learn, continue to grow, continue to evolve. That mm-hmm. way, again, it goes back to that survive and thrive mentality. Mm-hmm. There's just so many exciting, wonderful things out there that are just waiting to be explored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, beautifully said. And final question, how can these wonderful listeners find you and support you and your organization?
Yes. So there's a whole bunch of different ways. Cool. There's our website. Mm-hmm. rmwalliance.org is a really easy way to learn about who we are, what we do, ways you can help us. But we're also on some social channels. So we are on Facebook at RMWA Wildlife. Mm-hmm. We are on Instagram at Rocky Mountain Wildlife Alliance. Mm-hmm. And then we're on TikTok as well, but I'm not sure I remember our handle. So that's relatively new. Yeah. So I can get that information to you. Mm-hmm. But those are the best ways, really. We have some community events coming up throughout the year. So keep an eye on our website and our social channels and come say hi to us at one of our events and say, hey, we heard about you on the Denver Audubon podcast.
Well, thank you, Emily. Again, this has been wonderful. The sentiments are the same, that it's been an absolute joy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dory.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who is tuning in from, again, wherever, whenever. And stay tuned for our next conversation where we create more bridges, create more connection, create more community, and create more animal love. So thank you. See ya. Hear ya. Next time.
And there you have it. This has been The Curious Bird. Thank you to our guests, our editor, Joe Escanos, and to you, our audience, for your time, curiosity, and openness. If you'd like to see these conversations continue, we would greatly appreciate your consideration in donating to our nonprofit, which you can do at the link in the episode information. Your generosity helps keep the conversations and our work flowing. To the bird lovers, the bird curious, the heart-centered, and any and every listener, until next time. When we meet again to build bridges, heal from separation, remember interconnectedness, and hear from the real inspired voices that are creating change in service to coexistence.